Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the future of investigative journalism with a guest from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
But first, we're talking with a chemical weapons expert about the latest news on Syria.
Reports say that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has accepted a Russian proposal to turn over all of his country's chemical weapons.
While there's skepticism from the U.S. government, unnamed officials have said that this could prevent an American military strike against Syria.
But how would all this work? Here to help us break down that question is Paul Walker, Director of Environmental Security and Sustainability for Green Cross International. He's also a member of the Board of Directors of the Arms Control Association. Arms Control, I should say. Paul Walker, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Glad to be with you.
So first of all, what's your reaction to the news this afternoon that Syria agreed to disclose the location of its chemical weapons, halt production, and show its facilities to the international community?
You know, I think this is very good news. It's sort of the one option that President Bashar al-Assad in Syria has, I think, to escape a really major military attack from the United States and allied forces. So I think it's an excellent step forward. Syria has dodged trying to join the Chemical Weapons Convention for 20 years now, since it first opened for signature in 1993. And it also puts pressure if he joins and we go in and can identify and inspect his weapons, it puts tremendous pressure then on Israel and Egypt, which are also two countries of the remaining seven which have never joined the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Well, it seems like a really tall order in the heat of the moment, in the midst of a war within Syria. The notion that outside inspectors could get in, figure out what all weapons, chemical weapons Syria had, verify that they've all left the country. How the heck do you get started doing something like that?
Well, the first thing is that President Assad has to accede to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and he can do that given his dictatorship. He can sign a document and join the convention, really almost overnight, I would think. And then under the convention, he has to, within 30 days, declare his whole stockpile, and that includes each individual munition has to be, you know, location, type, agent. He has to declare all of his production facilities related to chemical weapons production and all of his laboratories and research and development as well, and all of the launch systems he may have to launch chemical weapons. If he does that, which it sounds like from the news that he's willing to do, then the next step is that the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is the multilateral implementing agency in The Hague in the Netherlands, has to review that documentation and verify whether it's fully accurate and comprehensive. And if it's not, typically it is. You know, all but one of the declared possessor countries have fully declared their stockpiles up to now. Libya being the exception a few years ago. If it's comprehensive, then they can move right forward and start sending in OPCW inspectors to inventory the whole stockpile, really barcode, so to speak, every single weapon, and begin to lock down all the facilities until a destruction program can be worked out.
How hard would it be for a current signatory of the treaty, much less Syria, to keep some stockpile secret, to report some of what they got, but to produce and store chemical weapons outside of the purview of the Chemical Weapons Convention?
Well, the OPCW, you know, can only really inspect whatever the state party, the country, in this case Syria, declares. So when inspectors go into a member country, they inspect everything that's been declared, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, as we say. But they're not authorized to go searching, you know, like a detective for other facilities. So in this particular case where you have Syria, which has been suspected of having chemical weapons for a long, long time, and now, you know, a few months ago declared that they had a chemical weapons stockpile, and has allegedly used it as many as, you know, 10 or 15 times in the last 6 months, I think it would probably have to be, whatever their declaration was, would have to be very carefully compared with intelligence reports from other countries, namely the United States and Israel and other European and Russia as well. And if, in fact, we felt that there was some facility missing from their declaration, under the Chemical Weapons Convention, one can then request a challenge inspection, as long as they're a member of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And so a challenge inspection would likely be declared by the United States or Russia or some group of countries, and the OPCW inspectors are obliged then to go in and inspect that site, wherever it might be, within 48 hours. So I think a full declaration is actually quite implementable and quite enforceable as well. The big challenge, Rob, would really be the long-term destruction program.
And that was my next question. Suppose this happens, a military strike from the U.S. is averted, Syria really does reveal its entire stockpile, its production system. Then what? How do you get this stuff out of the country? How do you dispose of it?
Well, I think the number one question is, first of all, what's in the stockpile? So you have to determine, you know, what agents are there? Are they blister agents? Are they nerve agents? You secondly have to determine whether, in fact, they're weaponized or not. Are the agents in bulk storage, in barrels and containers, or are the agents in blister and nerve agents in weapon systems? The third question is, if they're in weapon systems, are the weapon systems also, do they also contain explosives and rocket propellant, which is the case in most of the American weapons we have here in the United States. And so once you answer those questions, you can determine what technologies may be relevant to destroy the stockpiles and whether you can transport the stockpiles at all. In most cases, certainly in both Russia and the United States, which are the two big chemical weapon possessor states, transport to any major transportation has been fully prohibited. So destruction facilities then have to be constructed in situ, sort of at the site, within, in the best of cases, a few hundred yards of whatever the stockpile depot is. So that may necessitate the construction of not one, but several destruction facilities of various types. Any sort of transportation of the stockpile is probably prohibitive, unless it's non-weaponized. In other words, you're not dealing with weapons, you're just dealing with agent, or better yet, it's not even agent. It's actually precursor chemicals, which I think some reports have said a lot of his stockpile may be in precursor chemicals, which are not as dangerous because they have to be mixed together first to form live agent. So if it's precursor chemicals, which are industrial chemicals, basically toxic, very toxic but and dangerous, but not a weapon, some of that could be transported to a central destruction facility, or even out of the country, if they wanted to build the destruction facilities in a contiguous country. But we're not talking, you know, moving these weapons to Russia or any distant place. I think at the most, you'd be talking about moving them perhaps into a more secure location within Syria, or, you know, one might even consider across the border into Turkey or Jordan. But I think it's likely that destruction would have to take place in Syria, because this is a dangerous operation. And then the question is, you know, under the civil war circumstances, could we in fact guarantee the safety and security of the inspectors, which have to be there on site 24/7 as long as destruction takes place, and or the construction workers, which would have to be there to build the facilities.
This is not something that's going to happen fast. Roughly, what would the timeline be if every step went well, from the diplomacy to getting the inspectors and the people destroying these weapons on the ground?
You know, I think in the best of cases, we'd have a full declaration and an inventory on the weapons probably within 2 to 3 months. I think that's kind of the time frame. We're not talking weeks. I think we're talking months in this case. And for destruction of the facilities, we'd be talking years. So I think in the best of cases, probably, depending on the size of the stockpile, probably 3 to 5 years is what it is. It's just a rough estimate. I mean, the United States, you know, has been destroying its stockpile, which is much larger, but has been destroying its stockpile for 23 years now, and we still have another 10 years to go,
wow,
at least. So we're talking 33 years in the case of the United States. But that's a stockpile that's probably maybe 25 to 30 times the size of the Syrian stockpile. In the case of Russia, Russia's been destroying its stockpile, which is 40 times or more the alleged size of the Syrian stockpile for the last 12 years, and still has probably another 5 to 10 years to go.
Paul, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Paul Walker. He's with Green Cross International, led the effort to establish the Chemical Weapons Convention Coalition.
Coming up, we'll talk about how investigative journalism is faring in the changing media landscape. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hear all the time that the media landscape is changing and that journalism is struggling to survive.
Well, the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters is taking on that question tonight with a panel discussion about the future of investigative journalism.
Investigative journalism is often seen as the crown jewel of the media industry. It uncovers secrets, wins Pulitzers. So, what role is it going to play in the future?
The Wisconsin Academy's panel will be at 7 o'clock tonight at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. Bill Leaders, the Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, will be taking part in the event, and he's here with us now to talk about the future of his trade. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism partners with Wisconsin Public Radio. And Bill, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Good to be here again.
So we hear a lot that traditional media is struggling in this digital age, but what do you see as the biggest challenges facing investigative journalism in particular?
Well, investigative journalism is often long-form journalism. It's a journalism that takes longer to produce. Usually it involves a lot of research, a lot of digging, usually some document work, sometimes some number analysis and data analysis. It takes a long time to do, and it's more difficult for media organizations these days to devote resources to that type of reporting, which is why groups like ours, like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, have come into being, because we provide some of the content to newspapers that can't devote that level of resources to this type of reporting anymore.
Well, we live in an era, too, when things seem to be getting increasingly bite-sized. People want news that they can digest quickly. Now, is that impacting the impact, I guess, and the staying power of investigative journalism?
Well, I think there's a place for long-form journalism and for investigative journalism. I think if you ask people, in fact, if you look at surveys of readers of newspapers, one of the things they'll invariably say they want is more investigative journalism, more long-form, in-depth journalism. And I think there is a audience for that. It's harder sometimes for people to devote attention to long stories than to short ones. But I think people do understand that there's value in a longer, more deeply researched piece of work.
Now, we had on Henry Blodgett, the CEO and editor-in-chief of Business Insider, not too long ago. And I don't know if you happened to see his piece, but he also went on a cable news show talking about how we are entering, he thinks, a golden age of journalism, and that the information is more widely accessible, more people are doing it, and there's lots of upsides and platforms. Do you share that view?
I do. I absolutely do. People talk all the time about how media organizations have gotten crunched, how newsrooms that used to have, you know, 70 reporters now have 30. And that's true. The size of news staffs has been cut back dramatically in all media, broadcast media and print media. But I think one thing that's also happened is the journalists who remain have been forced to up their game. They work harder. They do a better job of providing more within a small amount of time. And technology, to some extent, allows us to do that. When I started off in this business, if I wanted 25, 30 years ago, if I wanted to find an article that ran in the local paper, say, 8 months before, that would meant biking over to the public library and looking it up in an index and then finding the microfiche and threading through the machine and then getting a printout of it. You know, would take an hour to do what you can now do in a couple of seconds with the access of the internet. And I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of efficiencies that have been brought to the task of gathering and using information. And so reporters can do better. They can do more.
And yet you're talking about how there are fewer journalists in the newsroom. So does it make it less likely that, you know, young people are going to go into journalism and get trained and therefore less likely to produce, you know, another Woodward and Bernstein?
Well, I don't know. I think that the center is producing some Woodward and Bernsteins right now. I think our internship program shows that there are young people who are capable of being good and even great journalists, and that they're knocking on the door. They're looking for opportunities, and we can train them. We can make them realize their potential as journalists, as writers, as communicators, and they will go on to do great things.
What about making money? Because it seems like that's something that, you know, newspapers, look at the New York Times even, are struggling with. How do they make money off their content when it goes digital? And I would imagine that would be something that impacts investigative journalism particularly.
Well, we have to use a completely different model. We're not using the model of ordinary media, which is you sell advertising to support your activity and you sell subscriptions to support it to some extent. We give away our content to media across the state that want to use it, and we're entirely funded by donations and particularly grants. We're supported by people who see a value to investigative journalism, and that allows us to fill this niche that is out there in the market.
So is part of the answer more centers like yours across the country?
I think it is. There was that movie about the New York Times, I think it was Front Page, a few years ago, and it spoke specifically about the advent of the nonprofit investigative journalism centers being an increasingly important part of the new media terrain. There needs to be groups like ours to operate, you know, at the state level or at the level of within various interest groups that want to do this type of reporting, and they're thriving. They're springing into being in abundance, and many of them are doing well. I think the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is doing particularly well. We've grown steadily. We have a tremendous amount of reach and impact, and the future looks bright.
And yet the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism was in the news this summer because of its proposed removal from the UW system in the past budget. Now, that didn't come to pass, but was that seen as a blow to the center? How did you interpret it from where you are?
Well, you can look at it a couple of ways. You can look at it as a largely unfair and unfortunate attack that was predicated on misunderstanding or ignorance. And that's not a good thing. I mean, that was a very dispiriting thing to happen, particularly to be dragged into this this issue and into somebody's ideological battlefield. I found that very, very dispiriting and unfortunate. On the other hand, we received tremendous outpouring of support, literally from all over the country, from journalist organizations and from media outlets throughout the state. Dozens of people weighed in from the University of Wisconsin system, and our colleagues in the media, our partners, they all rallied very strongly to our defense. And in the end, Governor Walker vetoed the provision that would have kicked us out of the University of Wisconsin. And we think that was the right thing to do.
Got a question here from Willem in Colfax, who wants to know, how has corporate sponsorship of media impacted investigative journalism?
Well, corporate sponsorship isn't a part of our funding. We don't receive any money from any corporations.
But more broadly?
More broadly, I think that there is a need for media to focus in on how giving by corporations distorts the process, whether it's the political process or whether it's the academic and scientific process, or in some cases, the journalist process. If you're talking about corporate ownership of media, these are influences that affect the media and affect all other aspects of society. I think we're relatively free from those influences, and that's one of the advantages that we have. We're not beholden to any corporation.
Can you give me a sense about how many centers like yours there are across the country?
I believe there's about 50. I could be wrong on
maybe
that.
Maybe one in each state? Or
yeah,
are they clustered?
Many of them are state-based, and some of them are oriented around particular issues that that they want to do an investigation on.
Well, moving to how the media is doing right now, as a watcher and a journalist, how would you rate the media's performance lately when it comes to covering some of the big issues of the day, like Syria, evolving conflicts in the Middle East, climate change? What do you think when you sit back and look?
I'm proud to be a journalist. I think that my colleagues in the media do a terrific job. We do have less time sometimes to do stories than we once did. We sometimes have constraints that we didn't once have to contend with. But I think we've, by and large, risen to the occasion and maintained our professionalism and continue to provide something of value to our society.
And Bill, about 30 seconds, any advice you'd give young journalists out there?
Work hard. learn the craft and work hard at it. You're going to get better by doing it. And that's the only way you're going to get good at it.
All right. Well, Bill Leaders, thank you so much for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Bill Leaders, Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And that panel discussion about investigative journalism will be held at the Wisconsin, held by the Wisconsin Academy of Arts, Letters, and Science. That's tonight, 7 o'clock, at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the realities of working-class adulthood in an age of uncertainty.
We'll also hear why we need quiet to think clearly in today's noisy world.
And we'll learn how museums are making the leap to the online world.
Tune in tomorrow. That's all coming up on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the science behind modern-day attempts at immortality. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, fantasy writer Patrick Rothfuss joins us for this week's Geek Out segment.
First, it's a question humans have asked for centuries. Can we live forever? Science would probably say no, but that hasn't stopped people from trying to extend their lives and, in some cases, trying to achieve eternal life in either a physical or a spiritual form.
But there's more to it than just chasing the fountain of youth. Confronting immortality brings up all kinds of questions about the nature of life and death. Our next guest has written an extensive account that tries to get to the bottom of it all.
Joining us now is Adam Leith Gollner. He's a writer and former editor of Vice magazine, the author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with a dream you had. You were just getting going on this book, or maybe it was even before those seeds were planted. You dreamed about a particular fountain. Can you tell us that dream?
Yeah, the book for me began with this dream. I was in London. I thought that my next book was going to be about a history of labyrinths. And I was out at this hedged maze all day taking notes, and I fell asleep and had this dream, this powerful dream of a fountain. And I woke up and I thought, what does that represent? What is the fountain? What is the fountain of youth? What is the idea of immortality? And where did that come from?
And what happened after that? Did you decide that was a sign from the beyond?
5 years went by, and here we are. I don't know if it was a sign from the beyond. I just thought it was a dream, but it was one of those dreams that stayed with me. You know, sometimes we wake up from dreams, and they kind of haunt us throughout the day, and it was one of those dreams. You know, I kept on thinking about it and wondering, what is that symbol? Like, what does that represent? And where does it come from? And just the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there was a story there. So I was curious, and that's what happened.
Well, it's interesting when you think about it, and you go back through the ages, and it's hard to find a period. In fact, I don't think there is one where people weren't somehow obsessed, at least some portion of people, with living forever, whether it was a holy grail or a fountain of youth. What is it with humans that we are so obsessed with living forever?
Well, what it is that we can't fully make sense of death. It doesn't really make sense to us. We know that it happens, but we all suspect that there must be some way around it, or that there might be a way around it. And so we've always looked for solutions or for ways out of the inevitable. And that's part of what makes us who we are. We're driven to try to transcend our limitations, and so are all forms of life. You know, that's what kind of DNA in its very nature does. It kind of pulses forward and tries to become something greater than what it is. And I think that we have that within us as well. And we've always tried. We've never succeeded, but I think we will never stop trying either.
Now, in the beginning of your book, you start with some of the crazy and strange and weird things that we have done as a species, human beings, to try to extend and live forever. Tell us about some of those things that we've tried over the years.
There are so many things. I mean, that's part of one of the great joys of writing a book is the research phase. And for me, it could have gone on literally forever. I mean, I just kept learning more and more about the extent of what we've tried to do in trying to live forever. And I think some of the stories that really stuck out with me were the stories that took place in Imperial China, especially during the Tang Dynasty, when emperors were taking these elixirs of eternal life that were intended to make them live forever, but actually ended up killing them because they had mercury in them. Now, that's one of the more unusual phases. There are so many things we've done, so many methods we've tried, from alchemy to magic to chemistry, and they're all so interesting, but they are also all, so far, have been failures, which is, you know, kind of what brings us to today. Are we finally the one perfect generation that has the solution to this question that has been with us since the beginning of time?
Yeah, you've said so far. I mean, do you really believe that there could be a possibility of immortality in some form?
I don't know. I don't know whether I believe it or not. I think that I'm not closed to it. I'm certainly not somebody who is like an active believer in physical immortalism, like some of the people who I interviewed in this book who are really actively trying to make eternal life here and now a possibility. Like, I'm not somebody who wants that to happen, but, you know, all signs suggest that it won't happen. I mean, that's basically how I look at it. But do I know the future? No, that's also, you know, I think it's important to be balanced and measured and not to make predictions. I mean, I think some people make predictions, but as soon as you get into predictions of the future, you're a believer. And I don't think I believe either way. Who knows what science will come up with? But it seems unlikely that we'll ever find a way around this one certainty, death.
Well, one thing that people are trying and have tried for a little while now is this idea of freezing the body. And I guess the idea then is that you just hang out, you wait, and then wait for signs to catch up, and then you get revived, you get unfrozen, and boom, you're good to go.
Boom. There are a few leaps that you have to make in order for that to make sense. The idea that science will find some way of bringing dead bodies back to life. So that's the first thing. And we haven't figured out how to do that yet. And the second is you have to assume that there will somehow be some time in the future when we are able to resuscitate dead bodies and will also be able to cure them of whatever diseases they had or whatever it was that caused their death. I mean, it's, to me, going into the world of the cryonicists made me realize that it's just a funeral home. Like, we can dispose of cadavers however we choose. We can bury them in the ground. We can burn them. We can send them up on rockets and into space and firecrackers. However we want to do, we can bury them in the ocean. Whatever we want to do, we can do. And cryonics seems to me to be just another form of burial. They would not agree with that assessment. They do not see these bodies as dead bodies. They see them as temporary incurables, patients who are in suspended animation, and when the time comes, will be brought back to life.
You visited one of these places, right?
Oh, yeah.
What was it like?
I mean, it was eerie. It was a bunch of white thermoses, each filled with five bodies, which are buried head first in sleeping bags and covered in liquid nitrogen. And They have to be perfused, which is the technical term for having your blood replaced with antifreeze.
That doesn't sound undoable. I could be wrong there.
It was weird, and it smelled strange in there also.
And people do this to their pets too, right? It's not just human beings. I don't know. Are there any famous people who have, or their families have, owned up to having them cryogenically frozen?
Yeah, the two most famous stories, one seems to be an urban legend, would be Walt Disney. He doesn't seem to be actually frozen. And the second is the baseball player Ted Williams, whose head, or this is a potentially litigious topic, but whose remains are frozen at one of the facilities in Arizona. But that was big debate, and some of his heirs wanted him to be cryonically preserved, and others didn't, and it was a legal battle, and it's a whole messy situation.
And another area of this, you know, maybe getting more into science of the day, of the moment, that seems maybe more plausible to our computer gear brains, is that maybe at some point we could download our consciousness into a computer and live forever, yeah. I don't know, digitally.
Yeah, this is basically the latest take on the quest for eternal life. And we've always used leaps in technology as a way of making kind of leaps in judgment, where we say, oh, look, we figured out how refrigerators and freezers work. That means we figured out immortality. Or we say, you know, we figured out how to fly across the Atlantic Ocean with Lindbergh. As soon as he did that, he set to work on trying to figure out how immortality works. Every technological leap brings with it a tendency for us to think that immortality is right around the corner. So it's not a surprise that people have done this with computing and internet systems and cybernetic ideas and technologies. So what the singularitarians are saying, that's what they're called, they're people who believe in the singularity, which means the moment where human brains will merge with computers to become one thing, will find a way, they say, to upload our consciousness into computerized hard drives, therefore backing up our personalities. And if anything happens to our body, like let's say it gets hit by a truck or dies somehow, it won't be a problem, and we'll just need to download our minds into other bodies that will be likely made up out of nanobots and other robotic components. So in essence, what these people are suggesting is that we will find a way to become cyborgs. We'll no longer be humans. We'll be something else. They call it human version 2.0, and they say that that's how we're going to attain immortality. What I wonder is whether this is something that everybody wants. And most of the people who I've spoken to in the course of researching this book don't really want that.
Right.
But there's some real big money pushing for this to happen, and one of the goals of this book is to kickstart a conversation about the bioethics of this very idea.
Well, you also wonder, I mean, to play with that thought experiment, how the human mind would take to being lodged inside a computer. It's not what that mind is used to.
Definitely not. I mean, what these people would say is that we're going to evolve, and our mind is going to evolve, and we're going to be, you know, our minds are going to be heightened exponentially through the ability to interface with computerized technology. So they think that, you know, whatever we are right now is very limited compared to what we will be then. But these people are utopians. I mean, they also think that, you know, money won't be an issue, and we'll be able to live forever, and, you know, there won't be any medical problems. And, you know, they don't look at Wi-Fi the same way I do. Like, I think I travel a lot. It's often hard to get a Wi-Fi connection. And they're talking about, like, somehow having, like, connections between tiny robots in our bloodstream and Wi-Fi signals. Like, just the mess that that's going to cause to me seems like immense, and also like terrifying. But to them, they see it as just this perfect situation in which we're all going to live perfect immortal lives.
Well, we're talking right now with Adam Goldner about the science, belief, and magic behind living forever, and we want to hear from you. Do you think humans will ever unlock a secret to immortality? Would you, given the option, you know, perhaps to be downloaded into a computer or something else, cryogenically frozen, revived? Would you want to live forever? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get your calls and your comments right after the break. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now about immortality with Adam Goldner. He's the author of The Book of Immortality. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts and feelings about this on the Central Time Facebook page. Would you want to live forever if science did offer us a route to immortality? And I want to read a little bit from your book, Adam. We want immortality so badly that we're always ready to be swept away into unthinkingness. Pitchman claimed that injecting stem cells into our skin will make us young forever. But then women who've undergone pioneering surgical stem cell facelifts discover tiny bones growing in their eyelids. Each blink sounds like a tiny castanet snapping shut. That does not sound like what anyone wants.
I loved finding that. I mean, I definitely find some beauty in the absurdity of these attempts. And there's something about it that, you know, this idea of being swept into unthinkingness. First off, let me just say, I don't think we all desire immortality so badly, but I do think we have this kind of innate urge to try to find a solution to death. Like, nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to die. Some of us have a better level of acceptance of it than others. But whenever these stories come at us, like, for example, one of the stories that made me think of that idea of getting swept into unthinkingness, one of them is this story that was the cover story of the New York Times magazine about a half a year ago, where they said that they had found this immortal jellyfish in Japan. And it wasn't a news story, but I was kind of taken aback because I'd, of course, heard about this story several years earlier when doing the reporting for this book. And a writer had seized on it and said, look, we found this immortal jellyfish, and there's a scientist in Japan that's working on it, and I need to go out there and find out what's going on. And it was this breathless story of this jellyfish that has this incredible rejuvenating capacity where if you somehow almost kill it, it comes back to life. But it's the same thing as a worm in many ways. Like if you cut the head off a worm, it regenerates itself in some ways. Now, that story, you had to get to page 14 of 15 to be told that the immortal jellyfish isn't immortal at all. In fact, it's very easily killed, often eaten by predators, and it dies the moment you take it out of water. And so it was this interesting story to me, you know, that we could get so kind of swept up in the possibilities of it. And it seems to happen over and over and over again. And that's why it's hard to trust many of these pseudoscientists or people who aren't actually scientists who are saying, guess what? We can make you live forever. We found the immortalizing cell, or we found the way to target the genes that'll make you live forever. All you need to do is give us $1,000 a month for the rest of your life. And people are willing to do that. I mean, people are spending a lot of money on unproven treatments. And I think that the stem cell treatments are one of them. You know, this idea that we just shoot stem cells up and live forever.
It seems like a hard thing for us to outgrow as a species. Well, I want to get to the phone calls now. And we've got David on the line in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
I have a few comments. One, this downloading to Cyborg. Hey, if someone made a Cyborg download it, and then you're still alive, and now you have an exact copy of, oh, we're going to kill you now. Like, oh, so much for that.
You mean getting your personality deleted?
Well, yeah. I mean, here, if you're able to make an exact copy into a machine, and then the machine even does everything, but you're still there, you know. it's an exact copy of you. You know, you're going to kill yourself then? I mean,
So there's a lot of tangles to get inside when we talk about being inside a computer. What do you think, Adam?
That's for sure. I mean, I think that's kind of an appropriate response, I would say.
Okay, let's go to Jared. He's next in Green Bay. Hi, Jared.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Let's see here. First off, there's one... I'm kind of a science fiction goober, and one thing that occurs to me in this talk of the whole, like, you know, brain downloading thing, and even generalized immortality, is that it leaves out, you know, a problem that no matter what, you're still stuck with that personality. It's usually a thing you see in fiction where, like, the dude who's been alive for, you know, like, X hundreds of years eventually, like, goes insane just from the sheer weight of memory. Like, even if you fix all of our, like, physical problems, you still get, you know, that level of deterioration purely on a personality level. And also, I'm really not 100% on the whole thing with, like, with machines being so eternal. I don't know about you, but I've never had a computer that lasted for more than 5 years, whereas my brain has been operating for a good 25 now.
Uh-huh. All right.
Yeah. And one last thing I there's a game called Eclipse Phase that actually has some pretty good science fiction regarding post-singularity stuff like personality duplication, you know, like uploading into new bodies and so forth. So if your guest hasn't heard of that one, he may find that amusing because it's got a lot of pretty good thought-out stuff for how that actually affects the society.
All right. Well, thank you so much for those thoughts, Jared. I mean, getting at the question of, do we even want this? I mean, I think that's a sort of a poignant thought about being burdened with the memories of, you know, forever. If this goes on forever, there's a lot of stuff in my, you know, not nearly hundreds of years that I wouldn't mind forgetting.
Yeah. I think that the caller just brought up a great point, you know, that this is basically something that belongs to the realm of science fiction. That's how I feel about it. I love science fiction. I'm fascinated by it. I also love science, and I'm also fascinated by belief and religion. So I'm totally open, and I'm not a person with an axe to grind. But I do find it curious that many of the people who advocate for this sort of physical immortality through the singularity, they seem to have blurred the lines between science fiction and science. And they, you know, just because we can think it doesn't mean that we should necessarily do it. And so, you know, these stories are great for science fiction and for, you know, trying to imagine hypothetical outcomes of, you know, post-immortal societies. Great. Awesome thought exercise. But do we really want that to be actual science happening here and now? That's a whole other question, and it's a whole other conversation. And we see it happening again and again and again in the history of this quest for eternal life, where people look at what is kind of a mythology, or what we could say science fiction today, and they say, let's make that real. And that's what's fascinating about it to me.
Now, you did a pretty exhaustive search on this subject. You talked about it taking 5 years to write this book. And I wonder, did you find anyone along the way where you thought, you know what? If anyone could do it, it's this group of people. Maybe immortality, maybe just extreme longevity. Did you meet anyone or come across anyone like that?
I mean, I spoke to a lot of people who were spiritual leaders in the research for this book. So people who weren't actually looking for physical immortality so much as spiritual immortality. The idea that after death, some part of them will live on in an afterlife that they believe in. And they all had very interesting stories that to me were just as interesting as the stories that physical immortalists had. But all of them, to me, fell into the category of belief. None of them had a story that to me could provide me with any certainty. You know, none of them were like, oh, that's what's going to happen. All of them had stories that we could choose to believe in or not believe in. And I thought they were all good and valid as ways of helping people cope with the unknowability of death and of helping them deal with grief. I think that these stories are all important as long as they aren't being used to hurt anybody, which is also a possibility.
Well, we've got about 50 seconds left, but having given this so much thought, do you think that you would in some way want to live forever? Do you think most people want that?
I think most people don't want to live forever. I think what people really want is to have a long, healthy life that ends relatively painlessly without a long, slow descent into, you know, the final decades of age-related diseases and senescence. I think people would like to live to a ripe old age and be healthy throughout and then quickly pass on in their sleep. And I think that's what I would like as well.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much. It's been fascinating to hear about all this.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Adam Leith-Gollner. He is the author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever.
Coming up next, speaking of science fiction, we'll geek out with fantasy writer Patrick Rothfuss. We'll talk about video games as an art form. Do they tell as powerful stories as books and movies? And if not, can they? Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time. News is coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.